Hey there, welcome to another episode of Wish I Knew, a podcast where I speak with people about their success, advice, mentoring, and listening to their interesting stories about their careers. I'm your host, Gary Nowak, and today I've got a special and truly enjoyable one for you with my guest, Rand O'Leary. Rand describes himself as custodian to CEO. He's currently a senior VP at Northern Light Health in Maine, president of Northern Light Eastern Maine Medical Center, also held positions as a chief executive officer, chief operating officer. He's worked across Michigan, Oregon, and currently in Maine. Over 20 years of experience in surgical services, neurosciences, cardiovascular, ambulatory, physician practice ops. He also has a master's degree in healthcare administration. Some highlights for our session. You're going to hear me talk about Bob Ufer, and we're going to spend a bit of time on Michigan football because Rand grew up in Ann Arbor. As you know, Michigan football is one of my favorites. So Bob Ufer was a football radio personality. It was great to listen to. Also, things that we covered with Rand is a great career that he didn't plan out. And he talks about your career path not being very linear, that it can be zigzag. And as you're going through it, you may not understand why, but once you look back, you realize everything was there for a reason. Also, you're the only one in charge of your career. Nobody else is looking out for it other than you. The company provides a job, not a career. They provide a job, they provide a paycheck, but you are in charge of your career. That came through loud and clear with the advice that we got from Rand. I asked him about CEOs, him being a CEO, and he had an interesting response that his role is to build relationships, influence people, and communicate well. We also talked about the impact of COVID on hospitals and people. So, per usual, let me get out of your way so you can enjoy my conversation with Rand O'Leary. Rand, thank you very much for joining me on my podcast. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Gary. I'm happy to be here.
So I usually start out with your very first job. Can you tell me what that was?
Sure. I mean, I delivered newspapers when I was probably 13 years old, but I really think of my very first job was I was a dishwasher in a restaurant. That was the first real job that I had for an extended period of time, washing dishes at a very busy restaurant.
My first job was delivering papers. What paper did you deliver?
I delivered the Ann Arbor News because I lived in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
One of the best places on earth. I've been to Ann Arbor. University of Michigan plays into your background as well, I assume, right?
It does. My father was a huge, rabid Michigan Wolverine fan. He loved basketball, hockey, mostly football. My mother worked at the university for a long, probably 30 years. And we had season tickets when I was a kid for probably 20 years or so. So we went to lots and lots of Michigan football games.
So I'm going to provide a name to you, and I want to get your reaction. Mm-hmm. Bob Ufer.
Bob Ufer, loved him. My dad, when we were not able to go to the games, he would have radio blasting in the garage while he was working out there. And as you remember, Bob Ufer was a very colorful individual, had lots of euphorisms, and my dad just loved listening to him on the radio. We all did.
It was so much better. He'd have a horn, and it's 4th and 1, and Michigan's about ready to score. Honk, honk, honk. As for good luck, I really hope they pull through. It was better than watching it on TV.
Remember Michigan? Yeah, and he loved Bo Schembechler. I mean, I met Bo several times when I worked in the hospital. We took care of Bo after his heart attacks. So I actually got to meet him and get to know him a little bit, which was...
How was he?
He was great. He was nothing like you would see that, kind of maniac on the field. He was just the kindest, gentlest, friendliest guy. We took care of Bo and went to school with a guy named Andy Bacon, who wrote a book about Bo's leadership style. I actually still have that book, and they have his signature in it, Bo's signature. So he was great. He was definitely a hero of mine growing up as a kid.
So hopefully there's a lot of Michigan fans that are going to be listening to this because this is Michigan lore and probably one of my favorite teams to cheer for, to barrack for. So sorry if we digress a little bit, but this is a good opportunity to talk about Schembechler and Michigan football. Can you give us a bit of a snapshot of your career? Let the audience get to know you a bit.
Sure. I mean, my career it was certainly not planned out by any means. I came out of high school. I was quite interested in IT at the time, which was a relatively new field. I started off at the community college. I took a few programming classes and some other things, and I started really down that path. I moved out when I was 18. I moved out of the house and moved in with a friend from high school into an apartment. And, I didn't have a plan. I really didn't, it was just day by day. And when I went to the community college, I got exposed to a lot of different fields, and I became quite interested in emergency medicine. And so I decided to become an EMT, went through the program, became licensed on the ambulance part-time, and still worked at the hospital where I had taken a job in housekeeping on the night shift just prior to starting my EMT program. So it was a really interesting, I can't explain what it's like to work midnights as a housekeeper mopping floors, and then a few hours later, you're in someone's living room doing CPR on a family member.
So why EMT? What attracted you to that?
I think it was the adrenaline rush of being an EMT, the excitement. You know, I had not considered a medical career at all before that, even though my dad was a hospital laboratory director for most of his career. Healthcare had not interested me at all. You know, I just became enamored with that. It really opened a lot of doors for me. Like I said, I was still working at the hospital on nights in the housekeeping department, but because of my EMT work, I was able to work my way into a couple other positions that landed me ultimately in the radiology department, working in the what they called the specials area of the department, where they did a lot of semi-operative procedures. You know, it just took off from there, and I just kept getting as my education increased, my responsibilities and the roles that I were able to attain increased as well, and ultimately to where I am today as the president of a large hospital.
Well, that's a lot for the audience to absorb, going from housekeeping EMT, and now you're the president. So, right. And what I found interesting and I'm curious about is, you said you hadn't planned your career. What does that mean? You just followed what you wanted to do next? That was the next step?
Yeah, I like to say custodian to CEO. And a lot of people don't believe my story. You know, when I tell them, they think it's kind of made up. But it really isn't. It is my story. You know, I wish, there's no playbook for doing this. What I would say is that I was always incredibly curious. I wanted to learn. And when I felt I'd mastered one thing, I moved on to the next thing. And so that took me from unit management type position to business manager to director to VP to CEO. I just always had this incredible curiosity about different jobs and what they did. And I was advised in my career to just stay put. Got a great job. Why would you leave your job and move across the country? I'd say because I want to learn more. You know, there's more for me to learn. There's more experiences for me to have. So I guess I let the learning and the experiences and that sense of adventure have really driven my whole life and my career.
So you touched on something that I want to talk about is advice. What's the best advice you've been given?
When you say that, the thing that pops into my mind first, which I think is probably the best advice I can think of at this moment, was that you are the only one that's in charge of your career. And that's resonated with me my whole career. No one owes you a career. No organization owes you a career. If you want a career, it's completely within your control. And no one will look out. I mean, you might find some people to help you along the way, but no one's in charge of your career. Only you are in charge.
So in doing what we're doing, Rand and I are experienced in the same coaching program. One of my clients is a very nice young lady. And she was nearly made redundant. And it hit her that I poured my heart and soul into this company after X years. And now I was nearly made redundant. So when you said nobody owes you anything, we think that because we work for a company for X amount of years, that no, they owe us a job. And I think what I heard from you is, no, nobody owes you anything. I think it's good career advice for anybody.
Yeah, it might sound kind of harsh, right? But the company owes you a fair wage for the work that you're doing for the company. But they don't owe you a career, and they don't owe you a job. You have to earn that job, and even if you earn it, sometimes you can still lose it. I think a lot of, you know, they feel because I've done everything I've been asked to do. Therefore, when something comes up that I'm really interested in or promotional opportunity that somehow I deserve it, I'm entitled to it. It really doesn't work that way. It just doesn't. People can become very bitter and very disenfranchised when they feel like that they're owed something or they're entitled to it. The company owes you a paycheck for the work that you're doing. And that's really where it starts and stops. And it took me a long time to realize that.
What advice do you give people?
As far as if they're early careerists, I think the best advice they can be given is, number one, if you want something, you have to earn it. It's not owed to you. It's not an entitlement. But also, I would really like people to think about their career as not so much in a linear way. A lot of people feel like, well, you know, I've got my career all mapped out. You know, I get this job, and then I get this job, then I get this job. And if I don't get one of those jobs, that, you know, the whole thing's over. You know, my career has been, all I can say is it zigs and it zags, and try to follow your heart and try to follow the things that you're interested in and be open to having your career go to the left and to the right and not always in a straight line up. I think people can become very disenfranchised or even get down on themselves if they don't get that next rung on the ladder. Well, I can tell you literally hundreds of stories over the years of people who have achieved their career goals, but not in a straight line. You know, they've went here, they've went there, they've left the industry, come back into the industry. There's lots of ways to achieve your goals, and don't be so rigid on that big prize that you're not willing to experiment and take chances and take risk.
I think you're a product of that, because you said your career was based on curiosity and wanting to learn more. The advice I give to younger people, especially in their 20s, I think there was a time when you wanted somebody's resume or CV to have a long stint with a company. And now, and correct me if you don't agree with this, because I'm happy to be challenged, is the more diverse a background for a young person, even in their 20s or 30s, it's meant for you to try things, to experiment, to go from one opportunity to another. It doesn't have to be, as you said, a linear line. Mm-hmm. And that's the advice I give. You said follow your heart as well.
Right.
So I think that's a good perspective. What if you're a young person and you think you know you want to be someone like you, a CEO, mm-hmm. and you do think it's a linear path? Is there advice for that person? Stay the course, or how would you approach that situation?
I mean, I think it's okay to have a plan, but don't be so locked into your plan that you can't be open to other experiences. And I think if you look at the careers of CEOs, I don't care what industry you pick, and you really look into them, they have lots of different experiences. You know, lots of things shaped them. When I look back on my career now, it's easy to look back and see how it all fit together. But I will tell you, living it, it didn't fit together at all. There were times when I wondered, what am I doing? Why am I here? Why did I give up everything that I loved and everything that I was comfortable with and go across the country, for example? Why did I do that? Well, you know, I look back now and I see how all the puzzle pieces fit together. But at the time, this isn't something that I could have just sketched out for myself. It just happened. And I think it happened because I followed my passion and I was always curious and I wanted to learn. And that's made me more well-rounded person I am today, because I've done all of those different things. I've experienced all these different things, and they've shaped me as a leader.
How did you get through the tough times?
I have a great partner. My wife, Sandy, and I have been married for over 35 years. We met at the hospital. She was working in food service on the night shift. I was working in housekeeping on the night shift. We were both going to school at night, you know, trying to pay our bills, you know, working at the hospital. And we've been together a long time, and she's been incredibly supportive and flexible and willing to leave behind a lot of her career so that I could follow mine. And I couldn't have done it without her.
So this podcast is almost about a love story.
I mean, she's my best friend, and she's my partner for life. She's got the patience of Job.
There you go. Any major influences in your career that have been a foundation for you for all your great success?
Yeah, I think certainly my father was a great influence on me. He was a guy that I could always talk to. He had similar experiences, you know, in his career. You know, he would say, you know, at times, you know, I can only help you so far. I never achieved, you know, the levels that you've achieved. But he was a very good sounding board for me and a safe person I could, you know, be vulnerable with and talk about some of the issues I was facing. I've had a lot of great mentors along the way that have really influenced me, you know, helped me understand what it really means to be a CEO and what is the role, which is, you know, a lot different than maybe people might think. And so, yeah, so I've had a lot of great mentors in my life.
What is the biggest difference in a CEO where people's perception versus reality?
I think the biggest misperception is that that somehow you're in charge, that, you know, you're the top of the pyramid, the top of the org chart, and somehow you can just make people do things that they need to do. Another piece of advice that I did get from one of my mentors was as you move up the ladder into these higher and higher roles, that you have to get really good at relationships and you have to get really good at influence. And I don't think I could get anything done in my job unless I could build relationships, influence people, and communicate well. I mean, those are the three things that I have to do really well in order to get people motivated to do what they need to do.
You understand the irony in that because you said it. Because you think you're at the top of the chain, whatever you say goes. Yet you're telling the audience and myself, relationships, influence, solid communication are the three keys for you as CEO to be successful.
You know, that's the way I see it. I think, you know, some people may call it servant leadership or leading from behind. But, you know, actually, if you were to see my organizational chart, I'm at the bottom. It's completely the inverse of what you normally would see. I'm at the bottom, and then the people that report me are above me, and then it ends with the people at the top are the people we serve, the community, the patients, and the employees. They're at the top of my org chart, and that's just the way I see it.
In the industry, how have you been impacted with COVID in 2020?
Well, lots of ways, some good, some not so good. I think on the positive side, it's really brought us together as an industry, in my situation as a system, because we really had to work together and support each other, facing something we had no way to prepare for and no understanding of how much it would impact, you know, our lives. We've had to, you know, be there for the community, even when a lot of people were scared, you know, scared to come to work, scared to take care of our patients because of the potential risk of infection. Very early days of COVID, it was just unknown, you know, what might happen and how big it was going to get. So I think the silver lining in a lot of this is it's really brought us together around what's important in our lives and taking care of each other and supporting one another, facing our fears in order to care for other people. Healthcare, I think, has, you know, shown, I think, the whole country how valuable it is to have a really good health system accessible to you and the importance of that, the importance of community as well. On the challenging side, it's been financially, it's been quite devastating to many, many organizations, even though there's been some help through the federal government, it isn't going to be nearly enough. So I think the fallout from all of this is still to be felt in the healthcare system side. I think we may still see a lot of institutions that are not able to continue because of the financial implications of COVID. And we're not out of the woods yet by any means. We're on the backside of this is the way we feel, but with the different variants of the virus that are emerging, hard to say. So we have to be vigilant. We have to continue to do all the things we've talked about, the masking and the distancing, and we need to get our vaccines, and we need to try to slay this beast.
What kind of reaction have you had from the community, specifically after the vaccine has been found and the administration of that?
Yeah, the community support has been just phenomenal. It's been difficult for everyone. We've had to give up a lot of the things that we really love. We now know there's certain things that we miss that maybe we took for granted before. And as the vaccine has come out, there's had to, you know, we've had to ration, you know, vaccine and really focus on the most vulnerable. I would say, generally speaking, people have been pretty good about that. But the longer this goes on, I think the more anxious folks become. So I'm very glad to see that, you know, more vaccines becoming available, and it's becoming more widely available to more age groups. And I think that's going to go a long ways to really calm the waters with some folks. But I would say overall, you know, 99.9% of the time, people have been great and very supportive.
Have you been vaccinated?
Yes, I have.
Which vaccine did you get?
I was given the Pfizer vaccine.
Any side effects?
No, I did not have any side effects. You know, other than a little bit of a sore arm, I had absolutely no side effects. And I was anticipating that I might. I don't know why. Just thought I might. So I was pretty pleased that I had, you know, nothing at all, just a little bit of a sore arm.
Just on a personal note, I had the first vaccine about a week ago, sore arm, and mine was Pfizer as well. That's why I'm asking. Anybody I talked to about Pfizer hasn't had a reaction, an appointment in 2 more weeks. So very excited. I thought for me, it was a little bit of an emotional moment, and I didn't quite anticipate that. Have you seen that in people getting it? Do you see emotion out there, either from your workers or from the community at large?
Oh, yes. Oh, my gosh. Yes. I've been working some shifts over at the mass vaccination center that we set up at the local arena. People are just so thankful, so emotional. It's really just fills my bucket. I can't even tell you. You know, a lot of the work that I do, I don't always get to see the end result of that in my role, or it could take years. You know, so for me, it's very gratifying. I told my wife this. I said, you know, you go to the vac center, you help people, they're thankful, you leave and drive home and you think, I really did something valuable today and worthwhile today. And you, so it's an immediate gratification, that you were able to help people and see the end result of that in one setting. It's been amazing. My wife's been working out there 2-3 days a week. And, I think everyone that's doing that, they're getting as much out of this as the people that are getting the vaccine. They really are.
And it takes a lot of volunteers as well, does it not?
It does. We are trying to process up to 5,000 people a day at our mass vaccination site. And that takes between 40 and 60 people every day to do that. And they're all volunteers. We have overwhelming support from the community. So there are days when we have too many volunteers. Everyone wants to help, which has been great.
Well, you said silver lining, and that is clearly one that you can pull together as a community. Kind of switching tacks a bit, what in your career has been that you would consider your greatest accomplishment?
Well, you know, it has to be this COVID response. I mean, I just can't think of anything bigger in my career other than, and I would say the accomplishment is we got through it. We got through it. We developed a plan. We kept everyone safe. We came together as a community. We're saving lives by, you know, getting this vaccine out. You know, I had a small part in that. You know, I mean, it took really hundreds of people to make that happen. And for me, it's very rewarding to know that I was a part of that. And I'm the kind of person that I love it when my team is successful. I just, you know, I'm the cheerleader. I'm the one, you know, coaching them up all the time. When they're successful, it really makes me feel good about what I'm doing, that I had a part in that. And there's nothing bigger than this. And, you know, there hasn't been in 100 years, and hopefully, knock on wood, it'll be another 100 years ever. So for me and my career, it doesn't get any bigger than a pandemic. We've done extraordinarily well. The whole country has.
Question about your team burnout. This has been going on for well over a year now. How do you handle that? Or has that been a big concern of yours in your role?
Yeah, it is a big concern of mine. And I think one of the roles that I play is to make sure that I'm on the lookout for this and that I create ample space to have those discussions with people. We spend time on this. We meet as a team every month, and a part of our meeting is a check-in, see how people are doing. But one of the things about healthcare is that there is a hesitancy, I guess, among healthcare workers to admit weakness, to admit that they're maybe scared. It's just viewed that somehow you're not strong, and I think it's the exact opposite. people are willing to reach out and say, I need help, I think that they're the strong ones. And so we create space. We have, fortunately, a mental health program within my health system. We've had those folks working with our team on burnout. You know, it was described to me, you know, this way, which makes a lot of sense. I think as human beings, we can handle tension, you know, short-term tension. You know, I'm going to give a big speech or I'm going to give a presentation. Everybody's done that. And afterwards you feel like something's been released in you, like you didn't realize you were tense. But after you're done, you kind of feel that, we've been under tension for a year, constant tension. So it's like a muscle that just can only be under tension for so long. And I think we're still seeing the results of that tension are starting to play out. We're seeing people leaving the field, early retirements, leaders taking early retirement, physicians, nurses. You know, we're starting to see, I think, just the beginning of that kind of PTSD, if you will, that COVID's going to leave behind. And I don't think we've seen it up until now because everybody's had their head down working so hard. But once you start to get beyond this and they lift their head up, I think there's going to be a lot of fallout from this. I really do.
Do you have an answer for releasing the pressure? Because your example was a good one. Before we speak, we have all this super nervous tension and then such a release afterwards when we complete the speech and walk off stage. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the better feelings you can have, especially if it went well. What can people do, and not necessarily in the medical field or just people in general when they do have a lot of tension? Or have you struck upon anything with your team to say, take time off, which is tough because you probably need every able-bodied person there. But have you developed any mechanism or, you know, tension release?
Well, you know, I think it's important to acknowledge that everyone needs some help from time to time. I think it's also important for you to find someone that is safe, that you can talk to about these things, that, you know, not your boss, maybe not your coworkers because of, you know, politics and all these things. And, you know, I have made use of coaches. I will tell you, in the last year, I have at least two members of my team who've been working with a coach. And I think that's good because they're working on some things and their reaction to stress and how they handle that. So I'm a big believer in that. I think that you have to find someone that you can work these things through. I think for a lot of us, you know, verbalizing what's going on and having someone help you put together a plan that isn't your spouse or your boss or, you know, your coworker can be very valuable. So that's what we've been doing. I think also acknowledging that it's okay to be afraid. It's okay to be tired. One of the things I do is I push hard on people to take their vacation time because I've worked in cultures where if you take vacation, you're weak or, you know, you're not as dedicated. I push on them all the time. I say, you know, you need to take your vacation. You need to disconnect. And I'm quite serious about that. I think everyone needs a break and a disconnect. We have people here that can step up and fill in. That has been very difficult, you know, especially during this pandemic, because you're working at such a high rate of speed. It's hard to step off the treadmill. And, you know, in some cases, people are worried if they step off the treadmill, they'll never get back on.
Well, in your industry, you step off the treadmill, there could be a ramification to patients and lives. So two things I want to talk about. One is coaching. The second is vacations, because I have a perspective. There are some tech companies or companies that are offering unlimited vacation. You can take as much as you want, which I feel is very passive aggressive from a company. If I were to lead a company, I would be a big advocate of you mandatorily have to take 6 weeks, 2 weeks at a time minimum for two of them. And 1-2 weeks, you can put long weekends and things like that. Why? Because if you offer endless vacation, I feel what's going to happen is people aren't going to take any because they're too worried, they're concerned, they're paranoid, I'm too valuable. Whereas if you take a model, you have to take 2 weeks off in a row. And if you want to take a month off in a row, fine. I think it's hugely beneficial for the environment. When you go to Europe, if you happen to be there in August, you will see businesses that have been closed. No, we're not going to be back for another 5 weeks. That's the way to go. So just wanted to share that. I don't know if you have a perspective on that or if you agree or disagree.
Well, I do agree. I agree. And my perspective is that my son, our son and his wife live in the UK. And holiday is 4 weeks. I mean, when you go on holiday, you take off a month. And no one even blinks an eye over there. And he has told me this is the biggest change from, you know, living and working in America to now in the UK. He said they really value time off. And no one, it's the culture there is it's okay. You know, the culture here is completely different. People cancel their vacations and they wear it around, you know, like a badge of honor. I think we're slowly killing ourselves by doing that. And there's nothing wrong with taking some time off. And I will say I speak from some authority with that because, you know, for years and years and years, I never took any time off. You know, it was always like, yeah, I got 5 weeks of vacation. I only took a week, or I had my appendix out. I was back the next day and I actually did that, which I wouldn't recommend. Just, you know, I have to think now, what was I thinking? You know, but, you know, culture can drive stuff like that. If you're in a company and that's the culture, then I would say they don't really value you. They really don't value you. So find a different company.
And this gets to your point. They're taking out of you everything you're willing to give them. And nobody's going to protect you from yourself. So if you need a vacation, you take it. And my perspective is, who are you? Are you that valuable? You can't take 2 weeks off in a row? Like, come on, let's be more realistic. And I guess that kind of leads into the coaching aspect, because you mentioned something that I found insightful. And it's no secret we're going through the coaching program, because talking things out, my metaphor with a lot of clients is we as humans need to talk things out. And if you were to talk to a coworker about your situation or your boss, they're not listening to you the same way a coach would, because we have no skin in the game as a coach. And in the short time I've been doing this, the reaction I've seen to the people that I've spoken with has been very positive, and we're still learning. So I'm doing my best, but that release valve. So when I asked you about how you get a release valve, your response was go talk to somebody or find somebody. I feel, you know, a spouse has a certain role, and that may be a person you talk to, but the whole coaching industry, I think, has gained notoriety or acceptance probably the last, 30, 40 years, Rand?
Mm-hmm.
Where we are an impartial person, non-judgmental. We are solely there to listen authentically, to not provide guidance, to ask insightful questions. And it feels like when a session of mine is over with, you kind of feel the client is a bit more released, or they have less anxiety, or, oh, I've been looking forward to our call, which just warms me from head to toe when somebody says, oh, I've been waiting to talk to you. So what's your experience with coaching? And is that part of your perspective? Sorry, totally long-winded. Nobody wants to listen to me talk. They want to listen to you. But have you seen that as well in moving to coaching? And maybe the question is, why have you moved to the coaching industry?
Well, yes, I'll answer that. So I think for me, it's something that I'm trying on, you know, to see how it feels and how it fits. I feel I still have, you know, more years to go and more productive years ahead of me. But it's something that I would consider maybe down the road as a second career after retirement from what I'm doing now. What I didn't expect to get out of it was that it's helping me be a better leader now. The skills that I'm learning, the talking with all of these different folks in different industries, I'm getting a lot out of that. And I think it's making me better and more effective in the role that I'm currently holding. And I've had those similar experiences to what, Gary, you're describing, where at the end of the session, I'm wondering, are they getting anything out of this? And so the best way to find out is ask the question, are you taking anything away today? And I think they're taking a lot away, but away from it by what they're saying. You know, I've had a couple of people, just like you say, you know, it is just so good to talk about this out loud. She goes, this is the dialogue that goes on in my head over and over and over again. She said, but, you know, this one client said, but, you know, verbalizing it, there's something about verbalizing things that help you get clarity and structure and direction. And so that's been really rewarding for me as a leader to know that I help somebody. I mean, that's just great. I love that part of it.
So I listened to a podcast, and the CEO of Spotify, Daniel Ek, was on with Tim Ferriss. I like Tim Ferriss and his podcast. And he said, Tim asked him how he spends his days as a CEO of a multi, you know, he's a billionaire. And he said, I'm more of a coach now than a leader. It's not a command and control. He said, I really want to understand what people are enjoying, where they want to go, what inspires them, how they can make a bigger impact to the company. I found that highly interesting in our world, and I'm making a similar career shift that I don't know that I'm trying it on as much as I know I like it and I feel like this will be my path. But when you hear a CEO of a large company talk that he's more of a coach than anything, and then I talk to people that are at managerial roles that are just working so hard, they can't be gone, they always have to be online, and just that juxtaposition of a powerful person in an organization is really just focusing on his people and making sure that they're happy, and by all accounts, enjoying it. Selfishly, I love the product. I think it's great.
Yeah, I would say, you know, at this point in my career, I'm leading mostly from behind.
Yeah.
And I really need to do that because I need to develop the people around me, and they're not going to develop if I'm always telling them what to do
right. And
how I want it done. So I push back a lot when I'm feeling pressure from my team to make a decision. I would say for many years, I felt like that was my role, just, you know, show everybody how smart I am, you know, and how I have all the answers. And I've really come to appreciate that it's much more effective for me to help them find the solution. It's important for their psyche, their confidence, their development. Long term, it's better for the company that I spend most of my time developing the people that are going to be there when I'm gone. And if I can do that, and I can do that well, I will get a lot of satisfaction out of it.
And I found when you take people with you and respect their opinion and implement their opinion, now they're part of the solution. If it's a dictating to them what to do, nobody likes that. Everybody likes, take my opinion. You know, I would be working on presentations and send it out to somebody. They'd want to change a slide. It'd be, you like that word over there? You want that slide? Great. Because now they're bought into it.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. It's leaving legacy is kind of what I grabbed from what you just said, is when you start teaching them how to fish instead of giving them a fish, or at least respecting their opinion, you'll be exponentially more impactful to everybody. No, really good advice. I think that's a good perspective from you. And I'm sure everybody on your team loves working with you.
Well, I hope so. Maybe not every day.
Not every day, not all the time. Oh, here's a bit of an eclectic question. I want to see how it hits you. Is if you were in a room with 100 people, where would you stand out as the top 10%? What do you do better than a majority of people?
Well, what do I do better than the majority of people? I think I'm pretty good at reading people. I'm pretty good at reading people and understanding what their needs are, what they want to get out of the conversation. And because I can read people pretty well, I think I can engage them and motivate them and help them feel like they're part of the solution. I've always been able to do that. I'm always a pretty good read. I've been, you know, told that numerous times in my career that, you know, after a meeting or something, I said, boy, I just didn't see that. You saw it, you know, and it's, I'm good at reading body language, listening to what people are saying and understanding what they're trying to communicate. And I do that with my own team. I have a large team. They're all highly accomplished, well-educated people. They've been to some of the best universities in the country. They're bright. They're very bright people, but they don't always have the answer. But I always believe that collectively we do, the answer is in the room. Maybe you have a little piece of it. Maybe I have a little piece. Maybe somebody else. So I have to create space within the conversation for everyone to be heard, because sometimes the person that's really quiet has the best insight.
Create space. That in and of itself is great. How do you create space in a room?
Well, as the leader of this particular meeting, I usually go around the table and I want to hear from everyone.
Yep.
And then sometimes you have to tell people to be quiet in a nice way, because they have a lot of type A's in the room, and type A people, they like to talk a lot and they have an idea a minute. So you don't like this idea. How about this idea? How about this one? You know, so what I do is I go around the table and I want everyone to weigh in and be heard. So that's your opportunity. So if you're not good at jumping in there, people are talking over you, this is the time to weigh in out with your thoughts. And that's worked. I've learned that over the years from other leaders, and it's worked really well. I mean, and then I think also being humble as the leader, I often will say, I don't have the answers and I don't know what they are, but we need to figure it out. And so just letting them know that I'm vulnerable and that I'm humble and I don't have the answer. I think it's empowering. But for a lot of people to speak up, because they know if they speak up, I'm not going to just shut them down and say, that's a dumb idea. You know, how'd you come up with that?
Right.
I mean, all ideas have merit. They may not be the best idea. They may not be what we need right now, but everyone at the table has an opinion and it's valuable and it has merit and should be considered.
So you're creating space by calling people out or, hey, Susie, we haven't heard your opinion. Bobby, can you provide that perspective?
Well, I even do that in large groups. You know, if I'm in front of 100 or so people when we have our big management meeting, I will walk around the room and I will ask people. And if no one speaks up, I will say, I'm not afraid to call on people. And then usually I'll get some hands and go up because, you know, it's like, I'd rather just go now and get it over with, you know.
That's leadership by fear is what that is, Rand. So I wanted to touch on something before we get into some rapid fire fun questions. You said there was a lot of zigs and zags in your career. What would you point out as the biggest zig or zag or that people that was just completely random that you did? You're like, wow, I wonder why I did that.
If I look back now at the trail, there's some significant things that happened that altered my life. I would say not getting the job that you thought you wanted is incredibly important. At the time, it doesn't feel that way. It feels like this is the end. I've hit the ceiling. I'm not going to be able to go any further. And that happened to me. I'd been with an organization for 14 years. It's where I started my career. I just couldn't seem to get to that next level. And I applied for a position that I was eminently qualified for. I thought I killed the interview. I knew the person hiring the position. I knew that she respected me, and I'd been given lots of indications that I was going to be getting this job, and I didn't get it. I never got a real good answer as to why. And the person that did get it was clearly not qualified. Didn't even meet the educational requirements for the role. I felt really that the rug was really, they broke the contract. I did everything I was supposed to do. I went and got my master's degree, and how could you give the position to someone who doesn't meet the minimum education requirements? And so I took my ball and I went home, which means I said, I'm leaving this organization because I'm just never going to get anywhere. And at the time, there were a lot of people that said, you are out of your mind. Why would you do that? You have a very prestigious position now. But that wasn't enough for me. I wanted to fulfill what I felt was my potential. And I wanted to learn more and do different things. When I look back now, if I would have got that job, there's a very good chance I'd still be there and I'd probably be miserable. That not getting that job sent my career in a whole nother direction. When I look back now at all the experiences, the places we've lived, people we've met, it was the best thing that could have ever happened to me was not getting the job.
Because you said the company doesn't owe you anything. And it feels like in that situation, you had the perspective they did owe you that job. You killed it. You did the MBA. You worked there for 14 years. It was a linear progression. And that might have been your tipping point. Well, I don't want to put words into your mouth, but that might have been your perspective of like, wow, I guess I'm not owed everything. It's not linear. And nobody, it's just a company giving me a paycheck.
Yeah, I felt, like I say, they broke the deal. I felt like, that they paid for my master's degree, on top of that. Why would you do that? I just realized, I think at that point is the only person in charge of your career is you. And so if you say you want a career, then you have to be prepared to do whatever's necessary to fulfill that career. And sitting in one place waiting to be anointed is not on anybody's agenda, but maybe yours.
That's right.
So it's harsh and it doesn't feel good, but it's very freeing, I will tell you, because guess what? Who's in charge? You're in charge. I mean, what better position can you be in? And I also learned when I took that risk, because I felt it was a tremendous risk to leave my comfort zone, to move across the state in this case, to sell a house we had just built, barely lived in it. My wife had just taken a job teaching fourth grade at a brand new elementary school. I mean, how often do they build schools, right? Never. She never taught a day. We moved her in and moved her out. And that's why I said earlier, I mean, her support's incredible. But after I did that, I took that leap and I realized, what's the worst thing that can happen? I take a job. I made a mistake and I don't like it. Just get another job. It's not the end of the world. And I think a lot of folks I run into that are early in their career, they hang everything on that next job. If I don't get that, then somehow the whole journey's over. It's not over unless you say it's over. You know, you run into a barrier, you go over it, under it, or around it, whatever it takes. And as long as you have that philosophy, you will achieve all your career goals. Absolutely. But it's, what are you willing to do to get there? And in my case, it meant leaving behind friends and family and going somewhere that I did not know a soul. Some of the very best friends I have in the world are in those places that I would have never experienced. I wouldn't have been willing to take a risk and leave behind what was comfortable.
Did you ever find out why you didn't get the job?
Well, no, you know, I did the whole went to HR and complain thing, you know, which didn't go very far.
Didn't go well.
I was offered an opportunity to escalate it up to the CEO of the company, which I chose not to do. I think it was, to be honest, I think it was a friendship. I think that these two people were friendly outside of work and they wanted to work together. And it was my first kind of slap of reality that just because you check all the boxes doesn't mean you're going to get the job.
Wow. And very courageous of you. What was your mindset? Were you totally pissed off? Were you just, because you said, I'm going to take my ball, I'm going to go home.
Yeah, I was.
Were you, honey, we got to get the heck out of here because these people just, they broke the deal and I am pissed. What were you thinking?
Well, it wasn't the first, you know, job I didn't get. It was probably the second one. And I think I said something to my wife like, you know, I'm never going to fulfill my career goals here. And she said something like, I know. I've been, which means you've been saying that for 2 years. You know, when are you going to get off your duff and do it? You know, we can come up with a lot of reasons not to take a chance. We can come up with lots of reasons not to take, you know, risk. It is scary. You know, for me, you know, we weren't wealthy growing up. The fact that we had put ourselves in a position to buy a home, you know, I felt like this is it. This is the pinnacle. I own my home. I never thought I would own a home. I've got kids. We're in a great neighborhood. We're in a great school. My wife's teaching in the school that my kids will go to. I think in my mind, I'm like, you know, you don't deserve this. Why would you do this? Why would you uproot all of this that you coveted and throw it all away to go try something that you're not even sure you can do? I don't know. You know, I mean, what motivates us to do things like that? I think in my mind, I just wanted to, you know, I just feel like you're given this one life and I just want to experience as much of it as possible. And I don't want to feel like I'm shrinking my way back into a corner somewhere. I think ultimately I must like taking risk and I like adventure. I think I like to take risk. I like to take adventure. I mean, I'm not reckless. I mean, I'm not going to go out bungee jumping or something like that. Although I've been parachuting. I did do that. I do fly small airplanes, but I think it's more calculated risk. It's up to me to measure the amount of risk that I'm willing to take. I surprised myself. You know, I remember when I got there and I had my first big meeting with the staff and I remember thinking, oh my God, what have I done? I've thrown everything away that was good. And I just jumped into this dark hole, not knowing what, if it even has a bottom. You know, but it all worked out. I think then I realized taking risk is how we grow. It's how we learn.
Getting out of the comfort zone. And our brain is not wired that way. Our brain is to avoid risk. So if you use the logical part, it's, nah, that looks kind of scary. It's safer here. So you just, you know, went right into head first into that.
I tell you, I've done this every time I've changed jobs. It is very simple, but I take a legal pad and I draw a line down the middle. And I write on the left side, reasons to stay. And I write on the right side, reasons to go. Every single time I've done this, the reasons to stay are all people. They're all relationships.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, you know, my mom and dad live here or my cousin lives here or my kids are gone. They're always relationship issues. And what I've learned is if these relationships are strong, they will continue no matter where you go. And so, you know, just because you're moving across the country doesn't mean all of a sudden, you know, the friends that you have will no longer be your friends, especially nowadays with, you know, all the technology we have. And the reasons to go were always career, learn new things, you know, learn a new industry, learn a new part of the country. They were always career goals. And the reasons to stay were always relationships and people.
Mm-hmm. What was on the other side of the ledger?
Now, this was on the left side. Reasons to stay. People.
No, reasons to go, the other side of the ledger.
Oh, reasons to go were all career-based, really. Opportunity to lead this part of the company, opportunity to advance my career, opportunity to learn a new side of the business, or it was all career growth, usually.
So you could have both. You could still maintain the relationship and friendships, and you could still have all the other stuff. You know, a lot of people have friends. I've got to remedy that. I got to try that on. I got to go start figuring out how to make some friends, because everybody seems to like these friendship things. So one day I'll get some friends. Do you want to have some fun? I've got some quick questions for you.
Sure.
If you're okay. Favorite movie or book?
The Godfather, all day long.
All day, all three?
Oh, I'll watch it. If it's on TV, forget it. It's over. I'm watching.
No matter what, you walk by and...
I don't care. I don't know how many times I watched The Godfather, but I love the first one. I always have a hard time between one and two, which I like more. Three, not so much. But I will tell you, if The Godfather's on, I'm in a chair for the duration. I love that movie.
Favorite scene or character that you just love?
You know, so many phrases. Go to the mattresses. I think when Michael... I just love the whole Michael character, and probably my favorite scene is when he's in the church serving as godfather during the baptism. And while he's in church and he's, you know, responding to the priest's questions about, do you believe in God? And at the same time he's there, he's orchestrated the assassination of all four of the heads of the families. At the same time he's in church for this holy of all holy events. I think it's just an amazing piece of film.
Al Pacino was incredible in that all throughout, right? Favorite meal?
You know, probably a really good steak and a really nice baked potato, which I don't have very often anymore, but I mean a really good steak, not something, you know, you cook on the barbecue, but something, you know, you go out to really good. There's several in Chicago steakhouses that I just love to frequent when we're there.
So steak is a bit too ambiguous. Is it going to be a ribeye, prime rib, New York, filet?
For me, it would be the ribeye. I think a really good ribeye, especially that little tiny piece that's always so tender and juicy that's on the side there. Yeah.
Rand, that is the right answer. You've passed that part of this podcast because, yeah, a good ribeye. Do you have a favorite vacation spot?
I'm going to say two because I love them both equally. One is Hawaii. You know, we've been to Hawaii, several of the islands. It took us 40 years to get there, but we finally did get there. And then we went twice in 2 years, which was great. But for the family, we have such great memories of Sanibel Island off the coast of Florida. Sanibel Island is just, we just love going there. It's got, the beaches are covered with shells. Thousands and thousands of shells. Every time we've gone there, we've just had great memories of Sanibel Island.
Which island in Hawaii is your favorite? Or your spot you go to?
Oahu.
It's right up there for me. Just on a side note, not that anybody cares about me, I want to tell you, I love going to Hawaii right around Christmas. I wake up at 4:30 before the sunrise. Sun will rise about 6:20 or so. So get up, I do yoga, and then I go to Starbucks or McDonald's. I grab a cup of coffee, and then I walk to Waikiki Beach when it's nearly pitch black. And then I just stand there, and I have music. And I had my coffee and I just kind of watched the sunrise over Diamond Head Mountain, and surfer comes out, another surfer comes, and it just starts getting brighter and brighter. And then that's my day.
I know. And we've done similar things when we've been there. You're kind of like, it's hard to believe this world exists. You know, we're out in the middle of the ocean.
Right.
Just beautiful. And
how does the ocean not kind of engulf it all, or, you know, a big wave and boom, it's gone. But
we like the less off the beaten path, and, you know, the Big Island is okay and it's fun and there's lots to do there, but on Oahu, something, you know, it's just the right mix of, you know, big city stuff and rural and relaxing. Yeah, so we really liked it.
Couldn't agree more. Do you have a favorite TV show of all time that you just love?
I watch Seinfeld every time it's on. I love Seinfeld. I love the writing. You know, my second favorite would be Frasier. I just think that those two shows were so well written. And they're very cerebral. Not everybody gets them. You know, my wife doesn't get it. She's just not a Seinfeld fan. I just love it. I love the characters. I love the quirks. I love all the, just everything about it. And to me, Frasier is very much like that.
Mm-hmm.
know, the just the little subtle nuances and the words they use, and the, I just think they're just maybe two of the best written shows ever.
So if you want Rand to sit down and you have him over, you got to put The Godfather on and he'll sit down, or an episode of Seinfeld.
Yes.
And then he'll sit down. Just on a Seinfeld note, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, that career, have you seen Veep?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
Is she not incredible in that?
Yes, she is. And what's the other one that she did for a while?
Christina or The World?
The New Old Christina or whatever. Yeah. Yeah.
How? She's just amazing. Okay. We could.
I don't know if you watch Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee on Netflix.
Yeah, with Larry David?
Yeah.
I saw it three times.
She's on there too. She's one of his guests. And that is another show that I will watch for hours because I love cars. You know, he's just got, I love the whole premise of the show, you know, just talking with comedians kind of off stage and then, you know, interjecting a beautiful car.
What I found great is the episodes are anywhere from 14 minutes to 18 minutes, but they record 3 hours. So he'll be with them and they distill it down to that. When he had Larry David on, did you see that one?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Okay. So John O'Groats, where they went, my first home I ever bought was in L.A., and it was probably 5 blocks from there. I could walk from my house to John O'Groats. So that was some. But that episode, when they said, I don't know how we ever wrote an episode, because they said, if we think it's funny, the audience will think it's funny. And that's what they went with. Part of my podcast is, if I think it's interesting or I want to talk about, I think the two listeners that are going to hear this will think it's interesting. So that's kind of, that's the baseline of where I go.
Well, you know, and I love stories like that. I love that movie, The Founder. I don't know if you've watched that at the story.
Yeah.
I just love that kind of quirky success story. And if you read Seinfeld's book, he talks about, I mean, that show really was canceled almost a half a dozen times in the first 2 years. If you go back and watch it, it's just awful. It's hardly, you can't even watch it. You know, the fact that it took off after it found an audience and got better and better. And I love those stories. I don't know now if TV, if there's enough room for that to even happen anymore. It's like, you know, if it doesn't hit right away, you just yank it. And
I think it's Netflix. It's going to, because Netflix will give it some time.
Mm-hmm.
And what I like about Netflix is they'll have a show, it'll only be 6 episodes. When you talk to Jerry, they had to write like over 20 episodes a season.
Yeah.
I talked to Ricky Gervais, who did 6 episodes or eight episodes because he was in the UK. And Jerry was like, okay, the first 9 or 10, you know what you're going to do. Then that anywhere from 10 to 15, he's like, what are you going to talk about? How are you going to write this stuff? And, you know, and Jerry, what are we going to do? So it's, how they got through it and 9 seasons. And he said he didn't want to do 10 because he just thought 10 was too much. He liked 9 and they stopped.
Pretty pretentious, yeah.
Yeah. Did you see when he was on CNN with Larry King?
Oh, yes.
Did you see the time when Seinfeld was on with Larry King?
I don't think I've seen that, no.
Go YouTube it.
Okay.
Because Jerry's reaction, he's not a pompous guy, but Larry King says something to the effect of, well, you weren't canceled, right? Jerry's like, canceled? We were the most popular show on TV. Canceled. He's like, well, I was just asking. It's like, Larry, there's a big difference between being canceled to being the number one show on TV. Get this guy my bio. You have to watch it. Oh. It's hilarious. Okay, last question. You could have dinner with anyone, dead or alive, and it's going to be a big prime rib steak dinner, no doubt. Who would it be with?
So this will probably surprise you. Lee Iacocca. I am so fascinated with this guy's life. I did get to meet him once. You know, his story, you know, being kicked out of Ford after inventing the Mustang, one of the most popular cars ever built, still is. And then his, you know, restarting his life and career and having such huge success really late in life is just, I think he'd just be a fascinating guy to talk to.
But didn't he have blinders on after he did that? Because I remember that because I grew up in Detroit. He was just the end all be all. He comes out with his book. And then he dropped off the face.
Yeah, I don't know about all of that. I just know that he did have a lot of health issues later in life. But I think what happened to him at Ford, because, you know, Ford is a family-owned company. And I think he got to the point where he felt he was bigger than Ford, you know?
Yeah, I can see that.
There you go. Here's a guy, highly competent, the best at what he does. He's taken to the company where it's never been before in terms of success, and he gets fired. And he ends up doing it all over again at another company and becomes really bigger than he ever was at Ford.
And Chrysler, he brought him back from nothing, if I recall.
You know, I have a little story there to tell you. So when I was in training to become an EMT, we did a lot of student rotations, and we would go to the substation, which could be anywhere. It could be a parking lot. It could be a fire station. But there was a substation at the Chrysler Proving Grounds. They had carved out a little room for us, and we would sleep there until we were called to go on a run. And we would wander around in the back where all the test vehicles were at. We saw these vans. They looked like vans to us, but they were small. And so we didn't know it at the time, but these were minivans. And we're looking at these things, you know, and they were all hooked up to the equipment. You know, they were testing them and whatever. Who would ever buy a minivan? This has got to be the stupidest thing we've ever seen. Why would anybody buy one of these things? Well, it goes on to be the biggest. It saved the company, right? Because the biggest single product market ever invented.
Well, good thing you're a healthcare executive and not an automotive executive, because your career would have ended pretty quickly.
And we've also owned probably four or five in our lifetime. At one time, we bought a minivan like three times in a row, because it is the greatest thing for hauling kids around and soccer and all that. But at the time, it was just so different and so new and so out of left field. You know, it just, who would want this? But
yeah,
apparently a lot of people.
Including you.
Yeah, including me.
The irony. Rand, really, I can't thank you enough for your time. Great conversation today. So really appreciate you being on with me.
Well, thank you, Gary. It was my honor, really, to be on your podcast. And I appreciate you asking me, and I enjoyed it as well. So enjoy the rest of your weekend.
All right. And go blue. I think they're on right now.
And go blue. Absolutely.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Bye.